Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
It's the Word in Your Ear podcast. I'm David Hepworth. I'm in North London, and at the other end of this, two cocoa tins and a piece of string arrangement is Alex Gold. Where are you, Alex?
I'm currently pottering sedately through the Messina Strait towards Greece.
Oh, right. Very nice. So you've just joined a cruise.
I have. I'm on here for 3 weeks, and it's mainly Italy and Greece, with a peppering of Malta, just sprinkled on top.
Have you met your fellow Beatles?
I met half the band walking to the stage yesterday. That's what this world is like.
Really? Go on.
Well, I don't know if I've spoke about this before, but the thing about Beatle world especially is, because these songs are all about arrangement, and you take away those arrangements that we all know and love from the records, and they cease to be the songs. So it's almost orchestral in that respect. The music is written and you play it in a certain way. And everybody does that. Everybody learns the songs in a particular way. So as soon as you've got the songs down your neck, you can play in any Beatle permutation on the planet and it will always be broadly the same. So in practical terms, this means that you can form a Beatle group at short notice from four people across four corners of the planet. Bring them all together, they can meet walking towards the stage door, and it'll all be fine, because they'll all be hardwired to play the songs in exactly the same way.
There is only one way to play Twist and Shout. There is only one way to play, you know, Penny Lane or whatever. It can only be done in that way. Yeah,
it's true. It's bizarre. The weirdest thing for me is trying to forge an on-stage connection with these people who you literally, 10 seconds ago, you didn't know. Because it's all about camaraderie as well. That feels kind of weird. But the notion that, you know, I won't know who I'm going to be playing with until I get there it's no longer so strange, or it doesn't feel as strange to you.
So are your fellow Beatles all British, or are they from all over the world?
They are. Actually, this time they're all Brits. Yep. They're all considerably older than me as well. Yeah.
So none of you are young enough to be in the Beatles. Let's be honest about this.
You know, let's be real. None of us are young enough. But actually, the Beatle world is populated by people twice as old plus
as the Beatles.
Yeah,
that's extraordinary. So you play tonight. Do you know what you're going to start with and what you're going to finish with? Does anybody do a set list?
Well, here's the thing. So I know that we're doing the Beatlemania show in the theatre tonight, which is one of the big guns. But I've got no idea what the set list is, no idea what we're starting with, no idea what we're finishing with, no idea if I actually know all the songs we're meant to be playing. So I might have to do a bit of swatting up. But another great thing about the Beatles songs is they're all really, well, you know, from John's perspective at least, they're all really easy to learn. Because There's no fat on them at all. There are no meandering kind of middle eight sections. It's all punchy, square, to the point. And by and large, they're all quite repetitive as well. So, you know, you'll have sections repeating themselves periodically throughout the song. So once you've learned the first 30 seconds, you've basically got the
You've learned
nailed.
It. Yes, yeah. true. The other thing, tell me how I'm right about this. I've always had the feeling about the Beatles that one of the great things about the Beatles is they started at the beginning. All their songs start at the beginning. They don't have long meandering intros.
Yeah, well, wasn't that story about, I think it was Can't Buy Me Love, and Paul McCartney wrote it as this kind of wandering blues number. And George Martin said, don't do that. Start with the chorus.
Well, they'd say Nile Rodgers' standard piece of advice, isn't it? Don't bore
that
us, get to the chorus.
Because
Nile Rodgers, who co-produced David Bowie's Let's Dance, which I think I'm right in saying came out 40 years ago, pretty much now. I think I'm right in saying that. And was David Bowie's biggest hit and his last number one. Yeah, let's not forget.
Yeah.
Nile Rodgers' key piece of advice with Let's Dance was when he first heard it, he said, start with the chorus. And once you've done that, it's a fundamentally different kind of record, isn't it? You know, because you've declared up front, you've shown your hand, haven't you, early on? Please love
Absolutely.
Us. Please dance. You know what I mean? It's got to be a hit.
I don't think it's ever been more important as a concept. You know, with diminishing attention spans, you've got to deliver that hit really, really, really quickly in order to get people to stay and stick around for the whole thing, you know.
Now, having talked about that, have you heard, in any shape or form, the new Taylor Swift record has just come out?
Yes, she's just released a single with Post Malone, hasn't she?
That's the one I was listening to this morning, which actually doesn't start at the beginning at all, actually.
But she's Taylor Swift. She can do whatever the hell she wants.
Well, can she? That's an interesting point, because I was reading with interest the reviews. She's put out this, what's it called, the Tortured Artist Effect or something like that. It's called Tortured Poets Department. Was it Tom Rundgren made a record called The Ever Tortured Artist Effect? I think I'm right saying that. Anyway, Taylor Swift. And she's kind of put out a double album, really. And Mark and I were talking about this only the other week in the light of the fact it was however many years it was, 30 years since Bruce Springsteen put out two albums on the same day. And we were saying, whenever people put out a load of stuff, what they're really saying is, I can't be asked to edit this. You know what I mean? Yeah, I can't do the difficult bit of this job, because I'm just looking at this from my point of view as a writer.
Okay.
You know, that there is always, I can't remember which famous author wrote a kind of long letter to somebody and said, do forgive me for making this letter so long. I didn't have time to write a short one. And there is huge truth in that, because the work in writing, and I would suggest the work in anything.
Well, you were saying to me just
is
last
the
week,
reduction.
I think,
is the reduction. That's the hard work. Go
you
on.
You were talking to me about the best man speech last week, weren't you? And
God, yes.
Very similar advice on that front. You and Mark both said exactly the same thing.
Which is, well, I mean, I always say with speeches, start in the middle and finish soon afterwards. You know what I mean? With a speech of any kind, the audience should always feel it's about to finish. And consequently, they ought to listen. And you have to approach these things. I think we were talking about this. Sorry, you just reminded me about this. You know, that I think giving a speech to a load of adults is just like talking to a class of seven-year-olds. Absolutely the same. Because the seven-year-olds, unless they can see a really pressing reason why they should listen, i.e. the immediate prospect of amusement or vital information that they might need, if they don't feel that, their attention just completely wanders. It's completely the same with adults. Utterly the same.
No, totally. There's a very fine line between feeling entertained and feeling held captive, isn't there?
Absolutely. So, you know, with with writing books or anything, you know, it's getting it down, you know, it's reducing is the hard work. Editing yourself is the hard work. You know, famous author, I can't remember who it was. Yeah, it's Dr. Johnson, I think. Samuel Johnson, all those years ago, says, when you've written something, read it back, find the piece that most pleases you, and strike it out.
You know, weirdly enough, I was just about to come to that, because I remember you told me that years ago, and I can't remember what we were talking about, but you imparted that absolute nugget of wisdom. And
I'm sorry about this, Alex. You're tethered to me and Mark. You know, you have to listen to our piece of advice come round every 10 years or whatever. We don't have much to add to it at all. But anyway, you know, with records, which is how we began with, you know, Taylor Swift, it's giving people 16, 18, whatever songs, it's not a good thing. You know, give them 10 that you think are really good. That you want to be measured on, you know?
I do agree. I don't think that she just can't be arsed, though, because I think it's pretty much understood that she's a grafter and she's not shy of a bit of elbow grease. My gut feeling is she's in her full, inverted commas, artistic flow. And
just so she thinks that whatever she has to say is really important. I think that's the issue.
She's in a pomp era.
It is really. She's in her own imperial phase, isn't she? You know, the definition of a golden age, there's another old quote, is a time when things work in such a way as to make you think they will work this way forever. And they won't. You know, nothing ever does. I was just looking at the reviews of the Taylor Swift record. And speaking to somebody who used to write reviews, and it's deeply relieved that I no longer have to write them. I get up every morning, spring in my stride, leap out, and yippee! I don't have to review some bloody record, you know, that somebody wants, you know, 100 words about by Monday or whatever. Because you then have to struggle to come up with an opinion. You don't have an opinion. Anyway, the Taylor Swift reviews are really interesting because they all appear in the papers and on the various different websites yesterday when the thing drops. And clearly all the people listening to it have only listened to it like 3 times. And of course it's a load of tracks, so they probably listen to it fewer times than they normally would. And most of them, given the enormous, unprecedented popularity of Taylor Swift, and the you know, the kind of vengeful attitude of her admirers to anybody who's less than respectful in any opinion about them, they've all pretty much said, "Oh, she's great, isn't she? Isn't she great?" You're like, "No, I think she's greater than you think she's great. No, I really think she's great." Whatever, and you know, it's all a little bit tiresome. I looked at the New York Times, and somebody has gone so far as to say, and I'm going to read the headline here.
Okay.
It says, "On the tortured poets department," which is the name of the record, "Taylor Swift could use an editor," is what this
radical
person. Well, you know, I tell you what I think. We could all use an editor. It doesn't matter who we are. You know, we could all use somebody else going through it and going, "Do you know, this could be shorter. You don't really need that bit. You know, and if you think you're above that, you know, you got a problem."
But I need an editor more than most is when you're the biggest star in the world, isn't it? Clearly.
Absolutely. And that's probably the one time when you don't get it.
Yeah.
You know, and going back to the Beatles, as we inevitably do, you know, they were each other's editors, weren't they? You can see that in Get Back.
Well, didn't
they're looking at the faces of it. Yeah, absolutely. And I was thinking about this yesterday. You know, we're always coming up with things that we think are remarkable about Get Back. And the most recent thing that struck me only yesterday was that George Harrison had kind of he got the basic idea of something, you know, the song, which some would say he got from James Taylor's song, Something in the Way She Moves, anyway, whatever. He came along with it half done and then says, what do you think, guys? Can you come up with a word, you know, affects me like no other, whatever. And John Lennon says, what does he say, pomegranate?
Pomegranate, yeah.
Just think of a word and the word will come eventually. Yeah.
Which is probably true, you know. But the idea that he would, that George Harrison would be kind of vulnerable enough, would make himself open enough to go along with a piece that wasn't finished and play it to the two most successful songwriters on the planet.
You know what I thought was equally intriguing? It was McCartney when he's writing The Long and Winding Road and going to Mal Evans.
All right.
Suggest words. You know, Mal, I can't think of a word here. Can you just think of something? You know, it's absolutely astonishing. You know, and you could argue that he was the biggest ego in the Beatles, you know, and he was still self-aware enough to go to the roadie and ask him for his input on what might be the best way forward. I know I always go back to Oasis, but Be Here Now is a really good example, because Noel Gallagher still says to this day that he wishes that someone would have come up to him and said, don't you want to maybe chop the last 16 minutes off that song?
Really?
maybe the first 3 minutes of the first single is helicopter noises and Morse code isn't the best idea. You know, and it's the same sort of thing, absolutely at the top of their game, and nobody would dare to say, you know, maybe this is the turning point for Taylor Swift.
Well, maybe. I also wanted to ask you about another thing based on listening to some of the album and reading this review in the New York Times. She says, I think it's she who wrote this review. Sorry, I'm going to check the name. Yeah, Lindsay Zoll. Yeah, sorry, I'm going to find the...
Okay.
For all its sprawl, though, the Tortured Poets Department is a curiously insular album, often cradled in the familiar amniotic throb of the production. Now...
Hang on, can I just interject here? What is an amniotic throb?
Well, it's a bit of a vague use of a metaphor there, but the amniotic fluid is what we all float in the womb, isn't it?
Oh, of course.
It nurtures us, okay?
Right.
And I thought it was quite a decent metaphor there, because I kind of know what she means, the familiar amniotic throb. And I read that review before I went and listened to it. And when you go and listen to the first track, which is the one you mentioned earlier, that's the familiar amniotic throb.
Yeah.
Because my point is, it's the familiar amniotic throb of most pop music nowadays. Because... most pop music nowadays is made in a certain way.
Yeah.
In that you can't quite work out whether that's what you might call a real instrument or some kind of synthesizer or some kind of, you know, effect generated.
And I've noticed this about a lot of bands that formed in the noughties, actually. Their most recent record, you know, the further along their careers they've gotten, the more difficult for me as a musician it is to identify instruments which are actual instruments. Like Kings of Leon, The Killers, The Arctic Monkeys, all their records seem to be comprised of a lot of sounds, but not necessarily a lot of instruments. And I'm not suggesting that's a bad thing for a second, but...
It's different. It is different. And it's interesting you should say that, because you and I, genuinely, we've not talked about this at all before. And you think the same as I do, because it was brought home to me the other day when I was writing a thing for the New Statesman about the 50th anniversary of one of my favorite records, which is Rich and Linda Thompson's I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight. So that's made in 1973, actually. So it's 51 years ago. And it's kind of it's a folk rock record, I suppose. It's in that kind of idiom. It was recorded quite quickly in Sound Technique Studio, which was in a former Victorian dairy just off the King's Road,
right?
Which is where John Wood, who ran Sound Techniques, used to. So he produced, you know, I don't know, you know, loads of people, incredible string band, and you know, I don't know, Fairport Convention, all those people recorded in there. Nick Drake's records were made at Sound Techniques. Some John Martin records were made at Sound Techniques. Richard Thompson, Richard Lynn Thompson, and so forth. Anyway, and I was listening to it, and it stands up ridiculously well, actually. But one of the things that strikes you about it, listening to it, is it's quite stark. You know, You can hear there's a drummer, there's a bass player, there's an electric guitar, an acoustic guitar, there are two singers, and then there's occasional contributing musicians, people playing crumb horns or whatever. And, you know, a bass singer comes in to lend a dramatic rumble. And then on one track, I think it's just one track, you have the CWS Silver Band from Manchester. So whenever an instrument enters, there's a drama to it.
Right,
because you can kind of picture it. You know, you can't help listening to this record and picturing the people doing it. Whereas the records that you just referred to, you know, records made in the last 10 years you no longer have that feeling at all. It's all just mysterious noise.
Absolutely. And it's this thing as well of, you know, your favourite permutation, whatever it may be, whether it's Richard and Linda Thompson or the Arctic Monkeys, you know how many people there are in that particular organisation and you know what it is they do. And you're right, when that sound comes in, you can picture that person doing that thing. Whereas if a strange, mysterious, unprompted sound just appears that isn't anything to do with the, you know, with the traditional permutation of this group, I don't know if I'm just, I don't know if it's just me, but it feels a bit bewildering, because you think who could be doing that and why? What, you know, it feels somehow out of place, I think. Unless it's a feature. If it's a feature, you know why they're there. If the London Philharmonic are on providing strings, for example, you know why they're there. Again, you can picture them. But if it's a stray synth sound, it's really hard to find a place for it in your vision of what that outfit should be.
But also, do you think it's also increasingly the case that we know, whether we know it consciously or not, that a lot of the noises, musical noises, being contributed on a wide range of records made in the 21st century are being contributed by people who are probably not in the studio. They may even be in different countries.
Get Lucky is a great example of this. The Daft Punk single.
Yeah.
That was made almost entirely remotely, apparently.
Yeah.
Astonishing. Noel Rogers dialed in his guitar from halfway across the world. And they went, no, can you do it a bit more like this? And so they send it back. He does it again. That's it. But that is increasingly how records are made, you know, completely remotely.
But it's not just how records are made, it's how everything is made.
Yes.
You know, because everything is made on, basically everything is made on keyboards, such as you and I have in front of us now, me in North London and you on a cruise ship out there. And so we no longer, you know, we read a newspaper or whatever, or you read it online, you no longer have a mental picture of people putting together a newspaper and they've just done it last night and then they've finished and gone to the pub. You know, you watch a kind of Netflix series, you no longer have a sense of a load of people on a kind of, on a film set with trailers and so forth.
Well, the thing is, I was making a piece for a commission a couple of months ago for a corporate thing, and I did half of it at home, and I was using the instruments I had just lying around. And then I went to Madeira on holiday and we had some more stuff to do on it. And I finished it just using my laptop. and using the sounds I found on my laptop and using my laptop keyboard as a guitar or a piano or whatever. And it all sounded perfectly fine at the end, and you wouldn't know. But I made half, pretty much put together half of this piece just using a laptop to make and making it sound organic. So yeah, it's a very strange thing, isn't it? You know,
it's very strange, but that's the way the world is. That's the way the sausage is made in the 21st century. And we'll be back in a moment with the story of how something was made in the 20th. After this.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So sad to hear the news that Dickie Betts of the Allman Brothers Band has died at the age of 80. Now, I wouldn't mind betting, Alex, you don't know much about Dickie Betts and the Allman Brothers Band. Am I correct?
You are indeed correct. I do not know that much about him at all, actually.
But you're probably aware of his...
I'm keen to find out, though.
Good. You come to the right place. but you are no doubt familiar with the probably best-known tune, and it is a tune because it's an instrumental, which is Jessica by the Allman Brothers Band, which for years has been the theme of the BBC globe-girdling hits. Top Gear.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with it, of course, but I've never known what it is. This is the first time I've heard it referred to by actual literal name.
That's extraordinary. See, because I never thought of this because, you know, to people like me and Mark, people of our generation, you know, it was the Allman Brothers' Jessica for like, I don't know, 20 years before it popped up on the soundtrack of, you know, as the theme tune of Top Gear. And you know, like most people, I probably thought, that's a really good choice, actually. It is amazing to me that I've listened to it for all those years. It first came out in 1973, and I've never got bored with it, ever. I just think it's endlessly appealing, that tune. It always just has a kind of heart-lifting quality about it, which, you know, accompanies the sensation of driving, I suppose. That's the idea. But I just thought I'd take this opportunity, seeing you're here and Mark Allen's away in foreign parts, to just recapitulate the extraordinary moral tale that is the Allman Brothers Band story.
Because
it bears repetition. So you may be somewhere in the deep recesses of your mind where you keep your library of rock images, have an idea of a kind of Southern American rock and roll band, you know, with curtains of hair.
Yeah, long hair.
Walrus mustaches probably involved. There might be.
Actually, there's a full beard in my head.
Okay, there will definitely be full beards. Yes.
Some kind of headpiece.
And, you know, the kind of chewing tobacco or smoking probably while playing long, you know, kind of fairly drug-addled, guitar excursions. You know, that's the idea one sort of Southern rock brand. Well, that is the Allman Brothers Band. That is, if you go and look at them, that's what they look like. Anyway, they came out of Florida originally, and they were formed around two brothers, Dwayne, who played the guitar, particularly the slide guitar, and Greg, who sang and played the Hammond organ. And they moved to Georgia, because they were managed by Phil Walden, who had been the manager of Otis Redding and so forth. So based in Macon, Georgia, and they became an absolute sensation as a live band in the United States in the early 70s. You know, so that for anybody who thought the Grateful Dead were far too noodly and not carnal enough, the Allman Brothers Band was absolutely perfect because they were kind of, you know, they could play greasy and sleazy, you know, they could do that. Yeah. But they're also fabulous players. And Greg Allman, really good singer. Dwayne Allman, spectacular guitar player, to the extent that he played loads of sessions. And so he played, you know, I think he played...
Did you Layla?
He did Layla. They brought him in.
Ah.
You know, so he is the person playing the famous riff.
Right.
You know, that we were discussing only the other week, you know. So he was a member of Derek and the Dominoes, which is a very short-lived thing, but he played famously on a version of Hey Jude by Wilson Pickett. And I think he played on The Wait with Aretha Franklin, you know. He was the guy that they all got called, you know, to contribute. But the Allman Brothers Band, when they weren't playing live and becoming enormously popular, they used to drink a lot, chase women, and ride motorcycles. They were good old boys, the Allman Brothers Band, you know. The famous old expression about Keith Richards, not so much burning the candle at both ends as applying a blowtorch to the middle. That can apply to the Allman Brothers Band. So they had a breakthrough live album, recorded the Fillmore, came out in 1971, came out in 72, I think, recorded 71. Huge hit. And, later in 71, yeah, and probably before it even come out, Dwayne Allman went on one of his motorcycle rides not far from Macon and had an accident and died. You know, so he was dead about the age of about 24, 25 or something like that, having done unbelievable amount of stuff in a very short period of time. And put out an album called Eat Peach, which was an even bigger hit, I think. Excuse me. Sorry, Alex. I'll drink a water. Yeah.
I'll pop in an edit point here.
All right. Come on. They put out another album called Eat Peach, which was mainly live and so forth. And then Barry Oakley, who was the bass player of the Allman Brothers Band, he also went out on his motorbike, you know, on the near Macon, Georgia. He also had an accident. He also died. Okay. Oh, wow. So within quite a short period of time, two of them had died. And so the Allman Brothers have to kind of reform, you know, get themselves sorted out again. So they get in a new bass player, and they get in Chuck Leavell as a piano player. And they start making an album. And Dickie Betts is the second guitar player. You know, so previously he's been in the shadow of Duane, but now he's the kind of lead guy. So it's kind of up to him to come up with some tunes. And he comes up with this idea, or he has the basis of this idea, for an instrumental, which he wants to call Jessica, because he's got a child called Jessica.
Okay.
And he works on it with his mates. And here he does, here he makes fundamental operator error, which will be familiar to many musicians. He calls his mate Les Dudek in and says, can you help me out with this tune? So Les comes in, and they're sitting around, as the Allman Brothers used to sit around, when he's smoking scary amounts of weed and playing. And apparently, according to Les, Dickie goes out into the kitchen to prepare the meal, which is, you know, this might be stressful for your Alex, steak, of course, because this is the early 70s, you know, and it's good old boys. Of course it's steak. And he comes back, and Les says, I've got an idea. I've got the middle eight. I've got it sorted out. I've got the bridge here, you know. And so they work on it, and they have the idea. And they play it to the rest of the band, and then they go and record it. And Les says, well, I want to play along with you, kind of thing. And so Dickie, obviously at this point, realizing I want the credit for this song on my own, it just says, no, I'll tell you what, Les, you just play the acoustic at the beginning. You know, you play the rhythm, and you can still hear it. It's on the record, you know.
Yeah.
And they go and make this record. And Jessica becomes kind of the lead track from the album Brothers and Sisters, which comes out in 1973. And it's a huge hit album. And Jessica becomes one of those things that just goes pretty much on the playlist of every FM station in the United States. They just run it for 10 years. You know, it's like Stairway to Heaven. It's that kind of tune. They just play it forever. And then, of course, years later, it gets taken up by Top Gear and probably loads of other movies and so forth. And so somebody must have made a fortune out of Jessica. Yeah. Well, it wasn't Les Dudek, who always felt rather ill-used by the whole experience, you know. Yeah. And so it's quite interesting. You know, all the Allman Brothers were all interviewed about this at various points over the years. And what they all said was it kind of should have been a band composition, really. And I think they're probably right, aren't they, Alex, with an instrumental. If you go and listen to that, they're all playing on it. You know, what makes it appealing is what they all do on it. It's not just the tune, is it? You know,
yeah.
It's the piano, it's the drums.
It's the arrangement, yeah, absolutely.
It's the arrangement. And they can't be doing nobody's doing the arrangement on their own, are they? Well, what's your experience of this?
Oh, gosh, it's kind of a nebulous area, isn't it? Because there's a real grey patch between what constitutes an integral part of the song and, you know, what is an incidental example of just the band playing a piece of music that's been given to them by the person or people who wrote it. I mean, there was that thing with the Smiths, wasn't there? And I think, weren't Rourke and Joyce suing Morrissey and Marr because they felt that their contributions to, for example, This Charming Man were of equal import to theirs? I mean, it's, to be honest, it's a real grey area because it really does depend on the song. I mean, I've had Jessica spinning through my head all the while you were talking about that. It was just right, on the loop. But what I was hearing with the twin lead guitars, and I wasn't hearing anything else really.
Well, so, okay, absolutely.
You can argue that everybody's listening experience is slightly different.
Okay, that may be true. And after this, just go and listen to it again. And, you know, it's they're all absolutely cooking on that thing, you know. I think the drums particularly, actually. And Chuck Leavell's piano part, you know, I think it would have been fair if that had been credited to the six people or whatever who were in the studio when it was done. But it wasn't. It went to Dickie Betts, you know.
Well, the thing is, as far as I can think, all the bands that I can think of that do compose by committee, regardless of who writes what, they don't seem to have any trouble with reallocation of, you know, Blur.
Blur, interesting point. Why did REM stay together so long? Why are you two still together after all these years? Because they split the credit.
I think it gives you, as a human, a better sense of the bigger picture, doesn't it? And it's a preemptor for the ego.
Absolutely.
If it sets us all out that way. Coldplay as well.
Really? Yes. Yeah. Is that the case? I suppose it is the case. Yeah. It probably will be the case with all bands going forward, won't it? You know, because
I think it makes sense. Because I mean, you could argue, I think, quite strongly that what constitutes a song is actually what's laid down on the record.
It's not a song; it's a record. It's what you're doing. Jessica is not a composition; it's a record. That's my feeling about it. And what a record, you know. So, you know, it is, as I was saying, perfectly chosen for Top Gear, for they wanted a tune that they could just, you know, it gave the program a kind of fresh start every time it was played, it seemed to me. It always had a feeling of a new beginning, you know, Jessica.
It moves, like it's propelled.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the beauty of it. It gives itself perfectly, I think, to the prospect of dynamic motion.
Yeah.
Like you experience in a car, you know. Absolutely. But thanks for clearing up what it's called. I've been wondering all this time, and now I know.
You probably don't even know that the tune for the BBC's Test Match special was it Soul Limbo by Booker T and the MGs.
I had no idea about that either.
You just thought it was that strange noise, you know, because all these things start somewhere, you know. But and I think they made the stupid error when they brought back Top Gear, and, you know, they've finally knocked on the head, haven't they, after that terrible thing that happened to Freddie Flintoff. They re-recorded the damn thing, didn't they, for the last series, which is a really stupid thing to do. It's like, I was only talking about this the other day, somebody was asking me about my time on the Whistle Test. And one of the stupid things they did there was re-record the Whistle Test theme, which again used to be started life as a thing called Stone Fox Chase by Eric Code 615.
Wouldn't that be because of master accounting reasons? Though?
Well, I don't think in their case. I know what you mean. I know what you mean. But I don't think that was the case with them. They just thought, let's do it again with a synthesizer, make it more modern.
Oh, God.
And the worst thing you can do is ever try to make the general rule. Another piece of advice, Alex.
If it ain't broke,
try to make anything more modern ever. Just don't bother. No point. People like it because it is what it is.
Yeah.
Nobody wants the modern version. They want the old version, you know, because they don't think of it as old anyway. They just think of it as classic.
You cannot bottle lightning. That's the thing, isn't it? And I've never heard that version, actually. I haven't watched Top Gear, but I hadn't watched it for years. But it's safe to say that I won't be seeking that version.
No, well, you haven't missed anything. Oh, I know what a further thing I was going to say to you about. Taylor Swift is that she has a song on this record where she mentions the Blue Nile.
Have you heard about that? Yes.
And the actual, I'm going to read you the line, drowning in the blue Nile, he sent me downtown lights. I hadn't heard it in a while. My boredom's bone deep. The cage was once just fine. Am I allowed to cry? Oh, dear. Anyway.
Pull it together, Taylor.
Pull yourself together, woman. You're a billionaireess or whatever. Yeah. Anyway, drowning in the Blue Nile. He sent me downtown lights. So the Blue Nile not only get name checked, they get their record mentioned as well, you know, the downtown lights. And here's my question to you. If you're a band seeking to be, you know, more famous than you are, what would you rather have nowadays? A 40-minute documentary on streaming television or a single mention in a song by Taylor Swift? Which is the most powerful in terms of increasing your standing? What do you think, Alan?
It's a no-brainer, isn't it? It's the Swiftie Association.
Of course it is.
I mean, God.
There will be right now, there will be fans all over the world
Googling the Blue Nile.
Of course it will. They're
cracking open Spotify and going through the whole catalogue.
And there it all is.
Because Mother, as the fans call her, apparently, Mother has mentioned it. And there we go.
And I'll tell you, the other interesting thing about the Blue Nile is in this case, loads of them will go and listen to them and lots of them will really like them.
Yeah,
because the Blue Nile, immensely likable sound, isn't it? You know what I mean?
For sure, but I think a lot of them will have decided they like them because Taylor Swift likes them also, evidently, too. So, you know, there's that kind of psychological aspect to it. It really cannot fail.
It can't fail. I bet the Blue Nile's figures are massively up this weekend. Now, why not? You know, I like the Blue Nile. I like to see him, known by more people. Because they'll warm to them, certainly. So whatever you might think of Taylor Swift's album, you know, she's doing valuable social work there in spreading the name of the Blue Nile. So, Alex, we should just reiterate before we leave the importance of people responding by liking and so forth and favouriting us and subscribing if you haven't done that already. If you happen to be, I don't know, are people watching this on YouTube? They might be. Might the Alex?
This will be on YouTube with a very lovely thumbnail that looks very pretty.
Right. So you can subscribe to that, can't you? You know.
Yeah, you can subscribe to us on YouTube. You can subscribe to our podcast feed, of course. And yeah, as you say, Dave, you know, liking, commenting, any kind of engagement, it all really helps and we all really appreciate it.
And the thing that helps most of all is if you're not already a Patreon supporter, you can go and find out how you could be one by going to patreon.com. Word of your ear. Is that it, Alex?
That's exactly it, yes. And there's a whole raft of benefits and goodies that you can experience with joy, should you wish to sign up, including the world's greatest birthday present, might I suggest.
Go on.
Which is having the pleasure of Mark and Dave coming digitally to your very abode, rummaging through your record collection.
Taking the mickey out of your record. That's what we do. It's important. It's an important social service. So, Alex, you're off for a day, you know, sucking fruity drinks through straws and pretending to be a member of the Beatles. Do you know what I'm doing today?
Go on.
I'm helping my wife, who's decided that she's going to get rid of a load of stuff that's in the front room on the bookcases. You know, I'm always saying, just thin out the books, you know. You don't need that. You won't read that again or whatever. And she's not often in the mood, but now she's in the mood. And she's, do you know she's finally going to do today? She's going to get rid of the large books that have been in the front room for years. For years I've been saying, do we really need those? And she looked rather hurt and said, yes, I just like having them. But now she's finally decided to get rid of them. And do you know what those books are, Alex?
Go on.
telephone directories. My wife has a complete set. This must go back, I don't know, the early 80s or whatever.
Wow.
You know, like five volumes of London phone books.
Here's a question. Are telephone directories still in press?
I wouldn't have thought they're still made at all. I wouldn't have thought so. No, no. And actually, I take the mickey and I think, well, it's ridiculous. We don't want them, you know, let's take them down the tip or whatever. But I know at some point today, I'll pick one up and I'll slide down into a sofa and you'll be able to find me an hour later still flicking through, looking for old addresses of people I once knew. You know, because there's nothing that brings things back more than looking at an entry in the phone book and seeing people's, you know, people's addresses. 23B Acacia Avenue, all this kind of stuff. It's like, it's time travel. So that's what I'm doing, Alex, and I'll let you know how it went next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with five different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.